There's 31, 44 copkeepers. It's heartbreaking. We have Mr. Apfel representing the Society Cooperativa Larcier. And we all know who I'm talking about if I didn't pronounce it correctly.
You did better than I did.
Okay. And we have been 10 minutes each by Attorney Trebatowski representing Coffey, Attorney Burnett representing Cartier Binda, and Attorney Lefebvre representing a reunion of the insurance company. And then, Mr. Atfield, you get 5 minutes rebuttal. Is that the way you all understand the proceeding? Okay. Mr. Atfield, Attorney Atfield, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mike Apfel. With me at council table is Winston Ostro, and we represent the Society Cooperativa Larciere. I believe, at least I've been told, that Larciere means workers, so roughly translated, it's the Workers' Cooperative Society. Larciere is, in effect, a temporary manpower agency. It provides laborers to various Italian companies, which lead them for limited purposes. Need them for limited purposes, and in this case it leased a handful of laborers to Cartier Binda in Liquidazione, which we will now refer to as Binda, to help on Binda's loading dock. Now the activities of Larciere's workers was dictated by Binda under Binda's supervision and control and subject to Binda's ultimate approval. Indeed, Binda's on-site supervisor has testified that Larciere's workers loaded this container exactly as it was supposed to have been loaded, and plaintiff has conceded that all the evidence shows that Larciere was not at fault. But despite its own witnesses' testimony, Binda has not made that concession, and so we find ourselves debating the propriety of exercising personal jurisdiction over an Italian company with no connection with Wisconsin, save for the fact that a handful of containers, its leased workers, helped load, made their way into the state. Now, as with all questions of personal jurisdiction, this appeal has both a statutory and a constitutional component. Now, and although either issue is potentially dispositive, this court has said on many occasions that we may not skip the statutory analysis. And so it is to the long-arm statute that I first turn. Now, it's widely acknowledged that when the long-arm statute was first enacted, it's almost 50 years ago now, I believe, it was intended to reflect what were then the established constitutional limits on the exercise of jurisdiction over non-resident defendants. Notably, however, the drafters did not choose to incorporate a catch-all provision as many other states have. Instead, the legislature chose to articulate a number of fact-specific instances in which jurisdiction could be exercised. And we must assume that the legislature intended its words to have meaning, and of course, with meaning comes limits. Now, what are the limits that we're dealing with here? Mercifully, perhaps we're dealing with only one subsection of the long-arm statute, that is subsection 4B. And the issue boils down to a question of whether Larciere processed, serviced, or manufactured products, materials, or things which were used or consumed in the state in the ordinary course of business. The trial court focused on one word, processed, and it held that the actions of Larciere's workers in helping to load the container with Binda's paper products constitutes processing of those products. We respectfully submit that the trial court was in error. Now, unfortunately, Wisconsin decisions are unenlightening as to the meaning of processed. However, we believe that all basic tools of statutory construction indicate that process should not include the mere loading of goods. We turn first, for example, to the dictionary definition, which indicates that processing means to treat or prepare as in manufacturing. And that implies a change in the product itself. Now, of course, the dictionary definition is not controlling, but let's take a look at the context in which we find the word. In as words, as we know, are known by the company they keep, and the word processed keeps company with the words manufactured and serviced, both of which imply some sort of transformation of the word itself. Let's think then about common usage. How do people use the word processed? Well, I submit that people in the normal course of events do not use it to include loading. For example, when you're in the checkout line at the grocery store, does the bagger process your food by putting them in the bag? I think not. Did I process my briefcase when I put it in the trunk of my car this morning? I think not. I would submit that the application of the word processed to the act of packing or loading is strained and unnatural. Now, of course, the legislature is free to adopt a strained and unnatural meaning if it chooses to do so, but I submit that they did not in this case. And I think the reason we know that is by looking at the way in which it used the word throughout the entire body of the Wisconsin statutes. As we pointed out in our brief, in a couple of long and incredibly tedious footnotes, whenever the legislature uses the word processed to modify a tangible object, and that's what we're talking about here, there are two things you can say. One, it always implies transformation of the object, and second, it never includes mere loading, packaging, or packing, and is usually used in contradistinction with these terms. All of these factors, we submit, indicates the only conclusion is that the word processed in the statute was not intended to include the sort of loading that Larchieri workers assisted in this instance. Now, the trial court focused only on one word, that is processed. The respondents have also suggested that perhaps Larchieri could be said to have serviced the paper instead. For reasons very similar to those which we have explained in discussing process, we do not believe that the word serviced can be stretched that far. Serviced has an accepted connotation of work performed on the product itself. In this case, it would be on the paper itself. And it usually results in renewal or maintenance. Also, when you look at the context in which the word is used, again, in connection with processed or manufactured, you come to the same conclusion. Service just can't be stretched far enough to include loading. And we also believe that this is consistent, once again, with the legislature's repeated use of the term, in this case, dealt with in our reply brief at some length.
Mr. Appenfeld,
yes.
We're going to look at context, and you just mentioned context. Why shouldn't we look at the context of what happened to the plaintiff here? Obviously, the loading was directly connected, or appears to be directly connected, to the injuries sustained by the plaintiff. So when we're looking at context, why shouldn't we interpret either serviced or processed within the framework of what occurred to the person who's raising the issue, the plaintiff in this case?
Well, I understand, Your Honor, that that there is certainly an impetus to stretch the words that far. But this court has said that, you know, there are limits, and that the long-arm statute has meaning. Perhaps the best case that comes to mind from this court is the Lincoln versus Seawright case, in which the defendant sent a dog into the jurisdiction, and it bit someone. However, that act could not be fit within the context of the long-arm statute. So if the long-arm statute, if the words are to have meaning, they must have limits. And I submit that they've simply, you know, while I understand that there is a reason and perhaps room to interpret certain words in favor of jurisdiction where that is possible, I'm simply arguing that I don't think that that's possible to do so here without doing violence to the words themselves.
Counsel, couldn't the court look at the particular sophistication of the process? You gave the example of loading the grocery bag.
Yes.
That you would say would be less sophistication than loading this type of placement of airbags, the attachment of toll boards to pallets, placement of bracing members at the end of the load. In other words, certainly from an unsophisticated standpoint, it sounds like this took a great deal of effort, and they knew that this had to be done correctly. So that's what I'm saying, that the processing seems to be greater than putting your briefcase in your car or putting groceries in a bag.
Well, two responses directly to your question, Your Honor. First, I am not sure that the mere complexity of the act can transform it into processing if it does not fundamentally change the nature of the object which is supposedly being processed. But that having been said, I really don't think that this act was quite as complicated as you think it was. I think it was perhaps only marginally more complicated than bagging. As a matter of fact, it was less complicated than bagging because there was no discretion left in the hands of larceny workers. At least a bagger has discretion to choose where he puts that nice soft piece of bread in your bag, usually underneath all the cans of tomato soup. But the larceny workers had no discretion. They were told by Binda, you know, they were given a diagram, put this pallet here, put that pallet there. They were given airbags, and there's not a great deal of sophistication. If there's a space between the pallet and the edge, you put the airbag in, you stick an air compressor to it, you inflate it till it's full. They took what were called tow boards, which were simply, I think they translate to essentially 1x4 inch, fairly lightweight pieces of lumber, and were asked to just nail them, they probably used a staple gun, across the foot of the pallets. And then they took a slightly heavier weight board, also supplied by Binda and cut by Binda, and jammed it into place at the end of the load. I don't view that as terribly sophisticated work, and certainly they were not, the Binda workers were not doctorate students by any means. I mean, they were there to perform manual labor. And it was done under Binda's supervision. But most importantly, it simply did not change the nature of the goods themselves. And it is for that reason that I'm suggesting the process simply cannot be stretched that far.
Counsel, the Nelson opinion,
yes, sir,
is an opinion, a hurdle over that you must jump over, I think. As I recall, the Nelson opinion deals with the distribution system.
Yes.
And it's a Seventh Circuit opinion,
yes,
interpreting the very phrase that's before us today, that is process. I think it is the very phrase before us today.
It does deal with it.
And there, as I recall, the court said you can look at these words, process to service, narrowly or broadly. And help me, I might be wrong. In that case, the Nelson case, they looked at it broadly. It involved a distribution system. They said it's part of the process of the distribution system. Ergo, there's jurisdiction. Why don't I take that Nelson case and say, we're dealing with a distribution system, part of the selling, the loading, the sending it to wherever it's going to be sold. Just like in Nelson, interpreting Wisconsin law, they made reference in the Nelson case to and trying to interpret that phrase that's before us today. They said in Nelson, as a general principle, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has determined that the long-arm statute should be given a liberal construction in favor of the exercise of jurisdiction, and they proceeded to do that. Why isn't that Nelson case then the answer to the question of the definition of process or service in this case?
I think that there are a number of reasons, Your Honor. First, obviously, when Your Honor was searching for a word, I think the obvious reason is that it is not controlling, obviously, on this court. But I think that there are other reasons. Frankly, I don't agree with it. I think that they stretched. So they took a big stretch and a stretch beyond what the words will bear.
Well, would you agree with what I said the case said, whether or not...
Your description is unimpeachable. But
okay, I'm going home.
I would suggest that first, Your Honor, yourself fixed upon one important factor, and that is the defendant in that case, Bunnan, I think its name was in fact a party directly in the distributive chain that took title to the goods and was responsible for their distribution, although it claimed it didn't really know where they were going. although the court then dismissed it and said it knew darn well where they were going. In this case, Larchieri is not really in that position. Larchieri is on the, is not terribly interested in the distribution except as the information gets from, you know, point A to point B within the factory, and what happens after that is a matter of absolute indifference to it. But I think, and also I think we note in our brief that the Court of Appeals there had no problem with due process. So with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, I think it was perhaps excessively liberal in its interpretation of the strong long-arm statute. But I think what the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals did not have before it was an analysis of the three, four, five score other ways in which the Wisconsin legislature used the word processed in throughout the Wisconsin statutes. That is, to signify some transformation of the goods itself, and in contradistinction to loading. And, Your Honor, that's how I would distinguish Nelson on its facts.
If you were a legislator and you wanted to include packing as an element for the long-arm statute, what word would you have used?
Well, I would probably use packing, or, to be quite honest, in this day and age, I would put a catch-all on there if I were the legislature and wanted to extend this to the full reach of the due process clause. But the fact is... I'm sorry?
What would the catch-all be?
Well, many states have them, and I don't have the exact language, but a number of states have a provision that basically says, in addition to all other grounds specified in the statute, jurisdiction may be extended to the outermost limits permitted by the due process clause of the United States Constitution, or words to that effect. Speaking of the due process clause of the United States Constitution, whether or not the long-arm statute provides for jurisdiction, we must still analyze whether the exercise of that jurisdiction is constitutional, and I would submit to Your Honors that it is simply not under the facts of this case. Now, the due process analysis is itself twofold. The first question you must ask is whether a defendant purposefully established minimum contacts with the forum state. And then, even if it did, does the exercise of jurisdiction comport with fundamental notions of notions of fundamental fairness and reasonableness? Now, in looking at the question of purposeful availment, the constitutional touchstone is whether the defendant has purposefully established minimum contacts with the forum state. Put otherwise, there must be some act by which the defendant purposefully avails itself of the privilege of conducting activities in the forum state, thus invoking the benefits and protection of its laws. Burger King, Hansen versus Dinklage, a host of United States Supreme Court decisions. And examples of such purposeful availment given by the United States Supreme Court would include designing a product to serve the market in the forum state, advertising in the forum state, appointing a distributor to market in the forum state, you know, otherwise doing precisely what the words say, that is purposefully establishing that contact. Now, by these standards, Larchieri simply cannot be said to have purposefully established minimum contacts with the state of Wisconsin. What did it do? It supplied temporary labor to an exclusively Italian market in Italy. Its few advertisements were confined to Italy. It had no agents in or contact with the United States. So deeply did it believe that it was not doing business in the United States that it had no insurance to cover its liability in the United States. It had no control over or interest in the destination of the goods that a handful of its laborers had been hired to help load. And it derived no economic benefit from the United States. It simply cannot be said to have purposefully interjected itself into the Wisconsin economy. Now, the respondents have contended that it was either known to, or at least foreseeable to, Larchieri that its goods would end up in Wisconsin. First, I simply do not agree. I don't believe that this record can support that contention. As we have talked in our brief, the few words that are found on the loading slips could not possibly signify to your ordinary Italian dock worker a destination in Wisconsin, USA. it was not known, it was not readily ascertainable. Moreover, even assuming that which is not in the record, that is, one of these workers was a particularly geographically astute worker, the fact is these were laborers. They were not Larchieri's eyes and ears. They were, in essence, its product. You know, they were sent out and on a temporary basis to work for someone else.
Counsel, is the focus what the individual laborer may or may not have known, or is the focus what the company knew?
Well, the focus should be what the company knew. Now, granted, there are situations in which a company only knows something through its officers and agents, but these were hardly officers of the company. And it was simply was wildly beyond any possible job description for them to be at all concerned about where these goods were going. I mean, and the fact of the matter is, they just didn't know where they were going. And that's, you know, the record has, gives us no reason to believe that they did know.
But it may be irrelevant whether or not the dock workers knew it.
Quite so, Your Honor. And in fact, since, well, moving on from knowledge, of which there is no evidence, to foreseeability, the fact is that mere foreseeability is not the criterion. I think that the most extensive discussion of foreseeability for our purposes can be found in the worldwide Volkswagen case. But the fact is the only foreseeability that counts here is the foreseeability of subjecting oneself to the foreign jurisdiction. And that foreseeability depends in turn on whether you have purposefully availed yourself of the law of that jurisdiction.
Can I ask you a follow-up question? True out that there was no insurance for the United States.
Yes.
If we had your client doing something that was indisputably processing or servicing, and it caused a problem in the United States or Canada, are you saying that there's just no insurance for that?
Your Honor, I have not analyzed the insurance policy, so I cannot answer that question. What I can tell you is that Mr. Berlini, the manager of the cooperative, was asked, do you have insurance for the United States or Canada? And he said, no, we don't, because we don't do business there.
Well, you have a dispute with Binda. Are you saying that because the injury occurred in the United States that you have no insurance versus Binda? I mean, when the acts occurred in Italy.
I am not sure, Your Honor. I told you I have not looked at the policy, and I'm certainly not familiar with the Italian law of insurance, and I can't tell you that. I can't answer that question.
Well, while we're talking about insurance companies, there's another appeal regarding the personal jurisdiction over Binda's insurance, right?
Yes, sir.
That's still pending.
Yes.
Will the decision in this case have any effect on that?
Well, again, depending upon the breadth of the decision, it could. I believe that the trial court reached its decision there on the basis that the insurance company had no contacts with Wisconsin. It is conceivable, although I don't know that it certainly was not analyzed under Section 4B of the long-arm statute, and I think that Mr. Lefebvre would probably be in a better position to answer the question.
Could I ask one other question? Hypothetically,
yes.
If your client were negligent, what should Mr. Kopke have done? How should this? If you're the party that's,
yes,
negligent, what is the proper way to get to your negligence?
Sue him. Sue it in Italy, and that is sometimes the answer. Italy, by the way, does.
You want a paraplegic or a quadriplegic gentleman to fly or get there some way to Italy to present the case?
Well, first, of course, the bulk of a lawsuit, the work, labor is done by lawyers and not by the parties themselves. But ultimately, he would either have, I suppose if he wanted to testify, there would be two options, to be transported to Italy or to testify via deposition and have the deposition testimony asserted there. But the fact is, if we believe that there are constitutional limits, that will be the result in some cases.
Let's for the moment assume, just for the sake of argument, your client was intended to treat in some fashion.
The assumptions you've asked me to make, which of course I protest, it seems to me that given the undisputed degree of control Binda had over the means and methods and ultimate result of what the large area workers did, that it would have to be 100%. It would be liable for 100% of Kopke's injuries and then could seek to recover, whether in contribution or indemnity, from large area.
And that's why Kopke didn't originally object when there were decisions made about lack of jurisdiction. When he moved to dismiss, he didn't care. Maybe I'm overstating.
Well, I think that perhaps Mr. Kopke's counsel can testify to his own reasons. I would like to believe they were because he felt there was no jurisdictional basis at that time.
It's not his position.
No, it's not his position now, and the parties find themselves in a rather curious position. I'm sure that Mr. Kopke would not mind if we had been dismissed on summary judgment on substantive grounds. But unfortunately, that would leave Binda with an empty chair to reach the point if we were dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. So, I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kopke. We'll have 5 minutes to represents Mr. Kopke.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Chris Trebatowski, and I actually went to Horning Middle School, so it's special for me to get to argue in front of some people that attended the same school that I did. Let me first go to the issue of the long-arm statute. And I really think that the issue that's presented to the court really has less to do with the long-arm statute than it has to do with the constitutional issue that's presented. And the reason that I say that is that if you look at the Nelson case, and you look at the statute 801054B, which for simplistic reasons is a foreign negligent act and local injury statute, long-arm statute, the term processed or serviced in connection with what Cupertiva did in this case falls squarely within the confines of the long-arm statute. Counsel referred repeatedly to the mere loading of goods and left out a big word. It's the negligent loading of goods, as argued by Binda. And in the Nelson case, when the Seventh Circuit addressed the issue, they said that to process has a broader definition of subjecting something to a particular system of handling, for example, or preparing something for market. The fact of the matter is that this paper couldn't get from Italy to the United States to go to CTI to be used in the stream of commerce unless somebody packed it in sea container or some other form of packing.
So the negligent loading of goods would make a difference if what you're saying is that they were loaded in the normal process, no negligence, you wouldn't have a lawsuit. But the point is, would it make any difference under the long-arm statute?
Well, I think that in this instance, that what we're dealing with here is a question of, was there a negligent act that occurred in a foreign location, which I think there was. Was there a local injury? I think there was. The question then is, does it fit within the definition of what constitutes a foreign act? And in this instance, the simple loading of pallets into a sea container is not what occurred. They were loaded, they were braced. There were a lot of things that took place, and that the action of packaging actually made the product so that it could be shipped. So it did not just, I mean, the product could not be shipped without the efforts undertaken by Cupertiva. And it is, in fact, this case in its entirety is a negligent loading case. It's a case where the pallet fell out, knocked my client to the ground, and he broke his neck.
Right, but I gather that the workers, the people who did this, were in the employ under the instruction of direction, etc., of Binda.
Well, there's no question, Your Honor, that they were under the direction of Binda. There's absolutely no question in that regard. And that is a position that we've taken in this case. But I would point the court to something that I think is important, and I'm sure Binda's going to argue it. The exclusive contract entered between Binda and Cupertiva states at paragraph 11, which is in the appellate, which is in our appendix, page 5, that Cupertiva is responsible for any damage to persons and things its personnel may cause, or any violation and or removal of material or documents of CSB property. I think that the contract itself between Cupertiva and Binda in that paragraph and in others says that Cupertiva is responsible for its negligence with respect to Binda. And Binda is going to argue, and I would if I was in their position, if there is that empty chair based on a dismissal, based on jurisdiction, the problem that it is Cupertiva's fault that they're here. They pounded the wood in improperly. That's in the record. That's the position that they're taking. Our position on the merits is much different. Our position on the merits says that you don't need to get there because all the loads were approved by Binda. However, with a jurisdictional dismissal, without a dismissal on the merits, we are facing Cupertiva appearing on the jury verdict form, and that moves me right into the constitutional issue because it affects the interests of this state. With the current state of the law regarding joint and several liability for tortfeasors, we run a very real risk in this instance if we let out a party that another defendant can claim is negligent on a jurisdictional basis and say, well, Mr. Kopke, you have to go to Italy to sue Cupertiva, of having a situation where he cannot, in the context of one foreign litigation, be made whole. He has to travel to Italy and sue different parties with different laws applying. Simply not in the interest of efficient justice. In addition, it seems to me to be a position that cannot be effectively advanced to say, look, we, Cupertiva, didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. They were in an international business. They signed a contract with somebody who shipped all around the world. And by doing that, and I think the Nelson case is instructive here, they are reasonably subject to the jurisdiction of the forum to which the shipping occurred because it didn't happen just once.
Mr. Trebekos?
Yes.
A question going back to what you said about the verdict. I'm not that well acquainted anymore with the trial of civil law. Are you saying that Binda could name Larcier on the verdict, and then that theoretically the verdict could come out 60% negligent Larcia, 40% Binda, 0% Kopke, and then the result of that verdict would be that Binda would be responsible only for 40% of those injuries? Is that
That's correct. If the judge decided that that Fukushima was an appropriate party on that verdict, unless the plaintiff proved that Binda was more than 51% negligent, that could happen. Now, there certainly would be arguments advanced as to whether or not the negligence of both parties should be lumped given their contractual relationship. However, that's an uncertainty that can't be resolved here. It can only be resolved in the trial court after the evidence is presented. And what we're saying here is, since Cupertiva had this exclusive contract with Binda to load for Binda, knowing full well that Binda shipped throughout the world, that once it did that, it met the constitutional standard of availing itself of the laws of this state if product was shipped here, just as Binda did.
What is the constitutional standard?
The constitutional standard is minimum contacts. And in this case, I think the hard...
Let me be more specific. Assuming minimum contacts, what is the constitutional standard as applies to goods and commerce, the stream of commerce?
See, I think that Nelson, again, is instructive. And the court in Nelson said that since the defendant was aware of a distribution system indirectly serving and deriving economic benefit from a national retail market, it should be reasonably subject to jurisdiction in the form where that market was created, if an injury occurs in it. And that's just what they have here. Cupertiva doesn't have a business if they can't pack for Binda that ships to Wisconsin. Just like the company in Nelson that made the flannel shirts said, hey, we didn't know where they were going to go. But the court said, wait a minute, you made the flannel shirt, you burned a kid in Wisconsin, it's got to go somewhere. If you're going to sell them and make money based upon it, you got to come here and defend yourself.
And look, just looking at, we used the word globalization this morning in the conference, and just thinking with business the way it is, then this means that a company that just packs, loads, packs, could go anywhere in the world. So you'd have to, when we talk about someone brought up no insurance, or you'd have to have literally, these goods could have gone anyplace. Isn't that the case? In other words, in that business that that the loading company is in, these goods could go any place in the world and they should be aware of that. Is that the position?
And my position is that if you enter that marketplace, you have to make the financial decisions commensurate with that, and you're subject to jurisdiction wherever it might be.
Please, the court. My name is George Burnett, and I represent Binda. I came to court with the objective of making 3 points today, and I, after hearing Mr. Hapfeld's argument, I want to add a fourth and begin with that. I think the central issue before this court is really the due process issue in the stream of commerce issue. But let me just speak very briefly to the long arm statute. I think if the following sentence makes sense, the answer to the long arm statute question, it should be easily arrived at. If this makes sense, large Cherry processed the pallets of paper involved here for transportation. If that makes sense, then this court's prior dictates that the long arm statute is to be construed broadly, liberally, and commensurate with the principles of due process dictate, I think, that the statute applies here.
What's the question again?
Yes, sir.
What was that question again?
If the following sentence makes sense, Leard Cherry processed these pallets of paper that we're involved with here for purposes of transportation. If that makes sense, that aptly describes what happened, then I think the 4B of the long-arm statute is met.
Even if they didn't know it was coming to the United States?
Even if they didn't go, if it was coming to the United States. And that is really the center, I think, of what we have going on here. We have a company that said, although we are processing something that we know is going to leave these docks, although we are processing things that are being packed in an intermodal container, so it could stay in Italy, it could be transported somewhere in continental Europe, it could be transported across the ocean. Nevertheless, so long as we are ignorant of the ultimate destination of this product, we are safe and cannot be sued. You may sue us in Italy, but nowhere else. That is their position. I think that a company that packs a container knowing that it's going to be transported elsewhere, that it's going to be opened, and that someone like Timothy Kopke is going to be open it and could be hurt and seriously hurt if they didn't do it right, should expect to be sued at the final point of destination, regardless of where it is.
Counsel, in looking at this the due process argument here, I look at the Asahi case, and in some ways that sets the framework. You have four justices saying that the test for due process is it has to be purposefully directed. Let me say a more stringent test. You have four justices that speak of what you need is awareness and then some economic benefit, a broader test. I hear you, and in your brief, you are, talking about constructive awareness or constructive purposefully directing. Tell me where you fit in between this four justices saying purposefully directed and four justices saying awareness.
This presents a unique case because in the Asahi Metal case we had this manufacturer in Japan or Taiwan, I don't remember which one it was, who said, we just gave our component part to the manufacturer and the manufacturer put it elsewhere. You had Justice Brennan's camp saying, well, you should have understood that that was going to be marketed elsewhere and therefore you're responsible for everything.
That's what I say is awareness.
Yes, and I fit into that camp. You had Justice O'Connor and her camp saying, well, there's got to be a little more information to a component part manufacturer that this product is going to California, to America, than what Asahi Metal had here. I say that this case is governed by the fact that we are dealing with transportation and shipping. We know that it's going someplace and it's probably not Italy. So it is not fair for a company to say, I can only be sued in Italy, even though I knew that the product was going elsewhere. As sometimes happens when I was driving down to this argument, my mind wandered. And one of the things I thought, if you take the appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, what would have happened if we were not dealing with a truckload of paper, a container of paper, but we were dealing with a tanker of oil, and Larry Cherry had loaded that tanker. And the ultimate destination was Chicago, and they knew that. And instead of deviating to the Green Bay Harbor, this tanker of oil made its way down Lake Michigan. And because of something they did, the oil spilled, but it didn't spill in Illinois. It spilled in Wisconsin and it polluted the shores of Kenosha, Racine, Sheboygan, Milwaukee. Would it be a fair point for Leargieri to argue, well, we didn't understand
American geography. We had never heard of those cities. Therefore, a Wisconsin court lacks jurisdiction over us to force us to pay for the cost of that havoc that we've caused. I don't think that that's the right answer. Yet that is the logical conclusion of the argument that this court is faced with today. The other problem that this court is faced with today, and it's a point that Mr. Trepetosky alluded to, is that in this day and age of international commerce, we are going to see products where components are made in Taiwan and China, where they're assembled in Mexico, where they're distributed to Tennessee, and they're sold in Milwaukee. It is entirely possible that we will never have a full adjudication of all the parties' responsibilities for a particular accident because this court cannot acquire jurisdiction over them unless it adopts the stream of commerce approach set forth in Justice Brennan's decision. Yes, Justice Prosser.
Could I ask you about the damage reports and whether that got back to Cupertino?
I don't know that who read those reports at Cupertino. I don't know that anyone ever saw those reports at Cupertino. I think the important point is that this was a regular pattern of practice for them to pack containers that ultimately made their way to America and Wisconsin. I think their point is really this, that so long as we don't appreciate American geography, where Wisconsin is, we don't really know which of the many Appletons or Ninas we're dealing with, we can't be sued here. That makes this case very unique because I don't think that their ignorance is synonymous with innocence. And I think that they have an obligation to answer for damages they cause in America if they're packing containers that they know or should have known are going to find their way here. All they had to do, and this is a point of I think, agreement between Justice O'Connor and Justice Brennan in the SI Metal case, all they had to do was ask. The ultimate question on due process is it fair to hail this defendant into court and force them to defend themselves there? In Worldwide Volkswagen, the court said, no, it's not, because that defendant, that retailer, that automobile distributor in New York, could have done nothing to prevent the effects of this accident in Oklahoma or to extricate themselves in that situation. In both the O'Connor and the Brennan decisions, they say if you can buy insurance, insurance or raised your prices to accommodate for that risk, or simply discontinue doing business in America. Say to Binda, we won't load your ships that are going to America because we don't want anything involved, but we want to be involved in their tort system.
Mr. Burnett, when we look at the idea of due process or substantial justice, Justice Prosser, I think, asked earlier how fair it would be to have a plaintiff have to go to Italy and submit to the Italian justice system. Don't we have the same thing on the opposite side here? How fair is it to ask Cupertino to come here to the U.S. and to submit to a foreign jurisdiction? How do we balance those things out?
I think that precise issue is addressed in Justice O'Connor's decision in the SI case, and she says it is a severe burden. But it's a burden that is imposed on companies doing business all the time. And I think it's a weighing and a balancing.
What is the burden on Binda?
The burden on Binda is to either, just from a practical standpoint, transport its Italian officers to America to testify in a Brown County court.
Sorry, I didn't state that. What is the, we have to take into account the burden on the defendant in determining what, I'm trying to figure out why Binda's involved fighting this. What is your burden for just going over to
Well, I think there's three things that are going on. First of all, such a lawsuit would take place, I would hazard to guess, under Italian law, and the rules may be different over there. I can't profess to understand them. Number two, just from a strategy standpoint, Mr. Trebajoski hit the nail on the head. Wisconsin's joint and several law makes it incumbent on the plaintiff to prove at least one solvent defendant is over 50%.
Yeah, that's the burden on the plaintiff, but I'm still wondering, why is BINDA fighting this?
Why? Because from a strategy standpoint, if I can prove BINDA is 40% at fault and his verdict is for $5 million, I pay $2 million instead of $5. I mean, that's... And then the third reason is that we haven't hit expert discovery in this case, but the fact that this particular piece of lumber that braced these pallets was pounded down with a pipe or a hammer, or fracturing or injuring the wood, may have something to do with this accident. So there may not be purely attributable.
What about the other appeal that's still pending on personal jurisdiction over your insurer?
I think that the court's pronouncements on minimum contacts and due process would be of important precedent in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I assume you want your insurance company to be present.
Good morning, I'm Dan LaFay from Quarles & Brady, and I am here on behalf of third-party defendant respondent Reunione Adriatica di Sicurta, and Darren, I hope, was the most difficult portion of my presentation this morning. Reunione is oftentimes referred to, and it's much easier pronounced off of an American tongue, as Ross, so if I slip into that this morning, that's what I'm referring to. Cartier Binda in Liquidation. It's actually Cartier Binda, the predecessor to the company that is now in liquidation. Correct. And reserve to be emphasized when it into the international field. Close quote. Justice Harlan penned those words 1965 in U.S. versus First National City Bank, 379 U.S. 378, page 404. Almost a quarter century later, the United States Supreme mentioned a few minutes ago, with the ever-increasing globalization in our world, it is all the more important that we recognize that these sorts of situations are going to be recurring. As the old saying in law, there is typically no burden imposed without some form of benefit. And before we seek to superimpose the burdens of our legal system on a foreign company, the benefit that we have grown to expect is encapsulated in the notion of purposeful availment. Because by purposeful availment, that means that you have sought to avail yourself of the benefits and protections of the forum's law, typically in a commercial context such as this. It is by someone who is in distribution framework, who's actually cultivating the sale and use of products within the forum. therefore there is a view that it's not unfair because they are economically directly participating in our economy to impose upon them the burden of understanding and learning our legal requirements, what constitutes a standard of due care under Wisconsin law. The common thread in most of the cases that have been cited, if not all, is that indeed the defendant that is found subject to jurisdiction has indeed actively cultivated a presence in the forum. Even under the more liberal framework of the stream of commerce approach, the courts have uniformly stated that the party understood that its products were being used and consumed, sold and consumed, in the jurisdiction. Here, Larcière is not selling anything to Wisconsin citizens. It has no additional benefit for the goods having been directed to Wisconsin. And indeed, it has no control whatsoever over how they are ultimately directed. It makes no arrangements for the intermodal carriers who take it from Crucinello, Italy, to the port in Genoa, to the port in Montreal, and there are by rail to the state of Wisconsin. And indeed, if we take the type of expansive view that is being advocated by the plaintiff and Binda in this case, well, each one of those clearly had their hands on these goods, and any kind of negligence that may have occurred while they were handling or processing this container should subject them to jurisdiction in the state or wherever it happens to end up.
I want to take a couple of points made by your opposing counsel and blend them. And it's this. Their argument would be, look, we have here a unique situation. That's what the trial court found too. Unique because we're dealing with shipping in international commerce, unloading an ocean freighter. And other argument that was advanced was to say that they shouldn't be held accountable for awareness that it is going to Appleton or Nina is to allow them to close their eyes to geography. So can you respond to those two points that what makes this different is the uniqueness of the activity, and also they should be allowed to close their eyes to geography.
Well, Justice Bradley, I think the cases that we have raised in our brief, such as Haley and then Egger, which I provided by a supplemental letter to the court, as they seem to indicate, and indeed it's Ross's position, whether or not Larcière knew where this container was going really doesn't alter the conclusion that there is no purposeful availment here. Larcière did not seek out Wisconsin and the opportunity to take advantage of economic dealings and transactions in the state.
Let me get this framework right. Purposeful availment, when it deals with stream of commerce, is defined arguably in two ways. Purposeful availment can be defined as purposefully directed, or it can be defined as awareness, right? Am I wrong or am I right? I mean, I thought that...
Justice Bradley, I would say this as far as the stream of commerce, it is, as we noted in our papers, what its contours are, I think, are subject to dispute, and whether it's awareness generally or specifically, I think can vary by jurisdiction, and those courts which deem to apply it either expansively or narrowly. And if you expect, I mean, what the Supreme Court said in Worldwide Volkswagen was that if someone sells their good with the expectation that they're going to be used in the forum, well, that's good enough for due process. Well, here, there's no expectation that Larcière was doing anything that was going to be consumed or purchased by anyone in the state of Wisconsin. One of the problems with the stream of commerce is it has so many eddies and tributaries and unforeseen destinations along its course of path.
Should they be held to an awareness that this product is going to end up over the waters at the destination printed on the paper or product? Should they be held to that awareness?
Well, I do not think that, again, that is dispositive in this case, because I think even if they had known, there is no purposeful availment of our marketplace.
Let me just extend that one. If it had said on the product, known by the employees and the company, the cooperative, it says, this product is being sent to Appleton, Wisconsin, which is located in the heartland of the United States of America. And everyone read that and everyone knew that. Assume that to be true. You'd say that's irrelevant.
I wouldn't say it's irrelevant, but I'd say there's still no purposeful availment.
Well, you'd say that it's irrelevant for purposes of this case and your due process analysis.
Again, I wouldn't say that it's irrelevant. I think these are factors that bear considering, but I do not think it's determinative.
Okay,
I do not think that it shows or establishes purposeful availment in the fashion in which it has been developed over the last number of decades by the Supreme Court as personal jurisdiction jurisprudence. One thing that I'd like to note, because I think it bears...
There are a lot of parties here, and I don't want to stay confused, so I'm going to say to you, you're Bindiz Insurance Company, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor.
You're not taking the same side as Mr. Kravatowski or Mr. Burnett. Why are you sharing the time with them? Why aren't you sharing
We were talking about before the arguments began that perhaps I should get some sort of a consulting and a fee on this one.
You're again these two guys. You're again Binda, and you're again Kaki.
That's
right?
Correct.
So you're not representing your insured.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That you got a separate little case going as to whether you want to get out again, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And
so I'm totally confused. You should be arguing with Apfel, right? With Mr. Apfel.
I think I can answer that. If I could answer that question, I think I could.
I waited until you have finished because I thought.
Because I believe I can answer your question as well as make the point that I was trying to drive home. One of the things that Mr. Kopke's counsel did not read on that page that he quoted from a little earlier in his arguments is the following paragraphs. Paragraph 16, it's the last sentence. Should the friendly solution be impossible, Larice will be the exclusive court where to go.
Say that again.
It's probably loses something in translation, Your Honor. It says, should the friendly solution be impossible, meaning a dispute over this contract between Binda and D'Arcieri, Varese in Italy will be the exclusive court where to go. At issue in the appeal involving my client Binda is the enforceability of a forum selection clause. One of the things that I think that it's the core and is very vital for this court to remember in considering this case is in developing jurisdictional standards, one of the things that the Supreme Court stated in Worldwide Volkswagen that is vital is that there be predictability and that defendants can shape their primary conduct so they have an idea where they may be subject to jurisdiction. This type of an effort, forum selection clause, I think is very substantial evidence as to how this party viewed it was directing its primary conduct.
Right, but they can't bind Kopke, of course.
No.
You agree he cannot bind
him? No, I agree it cannot bind him. I do believe that even if it were not binding, though, Chief Justice Abramson, it would be relevant, probative evidence on purposeful availment.
Okay.
What law applies to this case?
In terms of the disputes between the Italian companies, it has been Ross's contention from the outset that Italian substantive law applies and governs. For example, the construction of the insurance policy between Binda and Ross. As far as the tort elements and the duties of care, I don't know that that's been briefed. I would not presume to render an opinion on that, but I suspect that Kopke will argue that the Wisconsin substantive law should apply to that.
If Wisconsin substantive law applies, is that at all an element of the due process consideration?
I think it is an element that needs to be considered in terms of the types of reasonableness factors, the convenience factors that Asahi says you need to get to. If you reach a conclusion that there are minimum contacts, you still have to say, you know, what are the interests of each of the various entities, the foreign states whose interests may be implicated here. So certainly that would be relevant, and I would consider that to be an integral part of the reasonableness analysis.
Would say that it's within the statute and that it's within due process minimum context. What effect does that have on your appeal that's now pending?
I think it has potentially a marginal impact, and that is obviously if the court takes an expansive view, let's say it were to adopt a stream of commerce type of mentality that, look, if you have any kind of ancillary or collateral financial benefit that you derive from business that's done in this state, that's good enough. And obviously that is going to have an impact on a commercial entity that insures a company that at least claims it's covered by activities that it's doing in the state of Wisconsin.
How can it not have an effect on your case?
Well, the reason why ultimately I don't think it has a very substantial impact is that there are two reasons. One is the provision of the long-arm statute that is at issue is very different. And secondly, there is an undisputed enforceable form selection clause that mandates that disputes over this contract be adjudicated in one of two Italian courts. And the third consideration is that the direct action claim by Mr. Kopke, we contend, was waived. They did not appeal Ross's dismissals. There is no plaintiff against whom the question of whether or not we can enforce a form selection clause is at issue.
Thank you, counsel. We have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the most remarkable thing about the presentations of counsel for both Mr. Kopke and Binda is the lack of connection between their argument and the due process standards established by the United States Supreme Court. Mere foreseeability is not the standard. It simply is not. Goods that are sent off and make their way into parts unknown are not agents for service of process. There must be purposeful availment. And the reason for that rule, at least one of the reasons for the rule, is because of the fundamental freedom that the Due Process Clause seeks to protect. That is, the freedom to structure your own activities in a way in which you will not be subject to jurisdiction in other forums.
You're saying that they had to intend that purposeful availment means there had to be a knowledge that this was going to Wisconsin.
There must, at a minimum, have been knowledge, but there must be more than knowledge. You see, keep in mind, Larchieri is not a shipper. Larchieri's business is to provide workers. You know, people who come and lift heavy things is what it provides. It's Binda is the one, with a combination of other shippers, who is responsible for interjecting these goods into the Wisconsin market. Larchieri, neither as an organization or as its workers,
have any interest in where it's going, and they have no practical ability to control. So while I think there is absolutely no evidence in this record that indicates either that Larchieri or its particular workers had knowledge or even notice of where it was going, that in and of itself would not be a sufficient basis for the exercise of personal jurisdiction here.
One thing Larchieri does know is that this isn't going to stay in Italy.
No, I'm not sure they know that. I'm not sure they know that. No, Your Honor, if you could... No, Larchieri knows that the paper is not... I don't believe that I've conceded. What the workers know is that this paper is being loaded on an intermodal container, which is capable of being shipped to any part of the world. But it leaves the Larchieri, or leaves the Binda plant, on a truck. And that's as much as they know. The truck, as we now know, makes its way to Genoa, taken off the truck, put on a boat. It makes its way to Montreal, taken off a boat, put on a train. Trains eventually arrive in Green Bay, taken off a train, put on another truck. It could go anywhere. But it could also be put on a...
Would it be packed that way if it was just going to Genoa?
Could be going to Sicily.
Would it be packed that way then?
Sure. To Sicily, you've got to cross the water to go to Sicily. Could be going anywhere. But mere notice is not enough. Now, we can talk and spend a great deal of time talking about the way the various decisions in the Asahi Metal Products case come out. But what should not be lost on this court is the fact that that court was unanimous in its conclusion that in that case it would be unfair and unreasonable to exercise personal jurisdiction over that defendant, even though there was evidence that the defendant did have knowledge that its little valve assemblies were making their way into the California market. And I think even one of the concurring justices estimated that there were hundreds of thousands of these which had made their way into that market. The fact is that the fact they made their way into their market was still fortuitous. It was not directed, it was not encouraged by the defendant, the manufacturer, and it did not result in any particular benefit.
Counsel, it isn't the knowledge of necessarily of the individual worker, but of the company.
That's right.
And as I understand the facts, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm referring to part of the transcript that I have here, and that is that they were packed in, what does it say,
ocean-going or intermodal containers.
Containers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Containers which are capable of being put in. Now, the workers knew that. There's no evidence that Larchieri as an organization knew that. The record is simply silent on that regard. Okay. But I would contend if they did know that, it would not make any difference. Yes, Your Honor.
In looking at this notion of fair play, one of the factors we must consider, of course, is the burdens on the plaintiff. Here the plaintiff wants, of course, to be made whole. If you succeed, and if in fact Larchieri has, in some sense, is found by the jury to have been negligent, I think, to a large extent, we would be forcing Mr. Kopke to have to go to Italy to gain full recovery for the injuries that occurred right here, blocks from his home, possibly.
Depending upon the percentage that may or may not, percentage of attribution, it may well be that what that does is force Binda to go against Larchieri as it is contractually obligated to do in Italy and thereby pass the obligation through. In that situation, there would be no additional burden on Mr. Kopke. It is true, however, that you can envision a situation in which Mr. Kopke, to fully recover, might have to go to Italy. But if we believe that due process has limits, that sort of result sometimes obtains. Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Trustee, Mr. McBay, Beck, and Mr. Argy.